This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 1 Samuel. Now, here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through 1 Samuel chapters 27 through 31.
At the end of his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells a parable of two men. A wise man builds his house on the rock. A foolish man builds his house on the sand. And on the surface, there isn't much difference between these two houses. Perhaps they both had wooden studs and maybe a brick facade, perhaps metal siding around the other three sides. These two homes might have been constructed by the same builder, maybe using the same materials, perhaps employing the same methods. It wasn't until the hurricane hit that the differences in construction became apparent. The house that stood on the sand collapsed from the rain and the wind and the floods. And Jesus said, "Great was its fall." Whereas the house that was built on the rock, its foundation never budged. It remained solid. It had a steady, not a shaky foundation. And Jesus explained the parable. He said, "Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock." But then he identifies the foolish man, "Everyone who hears but does not do my words." In Jesus' parable, the foundation of each house determined its future. Jesus told this parable to his disciples. But he could have been describing the first two kings of Israel. David feared the Lord, so much so that he refused to harm Saul even when it was within his power to do so. Saul was God's anointed, whereas Saul, he had no fear of God. Always acting on impulse instead of conviction, Saul did what was best for Saul. Obeying God was not a high priority for King Saul. And as a result, because of the different foundations on which these two lives were built, when the pressure gets applied, Saul folds like a cardboard box in a thunderstorm. David remains strong. Tonight, we're going to look at the tragic fall of a once tall Saul. And the words of Jesus will come to mind more than once tonight. "And great was his fall." Well, beginning in chapter 27, "And David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul.'" Now that's not what David had just said with his mouth, remember. You remember the last chapter that we studied? Verse 24, after sparing Saul for the second time, David had cried out, "As your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all trouble." That was a statement of faith, but that's not what he's saying now. It's interesting, what he declared to the world, he now doubts in his heart. David has made the right confession. He said the right words. But now he's struggling in his heart to back up his prayer with faith. Sound familiar? Boy, remember, faith is measured by attitude, not by articulation. Twice now, David has had Saul dead in his sights, in the sights of his rifle, but he's refused to pull the trigger. Of the 600 men in David's posse, remember, 599 of them thought he was nuts. Only David had the right clue. Everyone had assumed that God had delivered David's enemy Saul into his hands so he could kill him. Only David thought that God might have turned Saul over to him so he could bless him and have mercy on him. This was such a huge test for David. Would David fear the Lord and honor God's anointed? Or would he not? Of course, David passed the test. But here was the problem. He passed the test and nothing changed. What happens to you when you pass the test and nothing changes? Hey, when you do the right thing, aren't you supposed to be rewarded? And isn't that reward supposed to come instantly? Don't all the stories of obedience have a happy ending? put God first and you come from behind to win the game? Isn't that supposed to be how it plays out? In his book, A Tale of Three Kings, Gene Edwards, he writes this about this particular time in David's life. He says, "These were David's darkest hours. You know them as his pre-king days, but he didn't. He assumed this would be his lot forever." You see, the combination of his crew's disappointment, God's apparent indifference to his plight, and his own disillusionment had caused a deep, dark depression to settle over him. David is just about out of options when he says, "There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand." David figured he'd be better off taking his chances with the Philistines than with King Saul. Then David arose and he went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And so David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. You remember chapter 21. This is now David's second try at hiding out in the city of Gath. And it's still a mystery to me why in the world he chose the town of Gath. Remember, this was Goliath's hometown. There weren't many friends of David over in Gath. He faced some personal family vendettas in the city of Gath. Well, it was told David, Saul, that David had fled to Gath, and so he sought him no more. And then David said to Achish, and this time David tries a different approach with the king of Gath. You remember on his first visit, he got cold feet before Achish, and he pretended to be mad. You remember that? He feigned a craziness and insanity. Of course, the king said he had all the crazy people he wanted in Gath. He didn't need one more, and so he sent David away. This time, though, David promises to be a good citizen. He says, "If I have now found favor in your eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country, that I may dwell there, for why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" All I'm looking for, king, is just a nice little suburb outside of Gath. Verse 6, "And so Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. Now, the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. For those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Whenever David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish." In other words, David eliminated any eyewitnesses. He didn't want word to get back to King Achish that he was attacking people who were friendly to the Philistines. Then Achish would say, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David would say, "Against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jerahmeelites," which were families of the tribe of Judah, "or against the southern areas of the Kenites, who were allies of Judah." In other words, David had the king of Gath convinced that he had turned into a desert pirate and that he had actually turned on his own people and their allies. It's my hunch that David was splitting the spoils with Achish so that King Achish wouldn't ask too many questions. Achish thought that David had turned into Captain Jack Sparrow, and his men were now the pirates of the Judean. Arrgh, don't you think? Now, David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, "Lest they should inform on us," saying, "Thus David did." And thus was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. And so Achish believed David, saying, "He has made his people Israel utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever." Now David has conjured up a clever ruse, but notice this. Though David is no longer in Israel, Israel is still in David. And David is functioning here as kind of an undercover agent. And he's actually pilfering these Philistine villages the whole while Achish thinks he's turned over and he's attacking the Israelites. You know, in a sense, this is the job of every Christian. Think about it. We live behind enemy lines. We're surrounded by the enemy. In order to survive, we need to live peaceably with the folks around us. But then we also need to use our position shrewdly. And while living peaceably in this hostile world, at the same time, we need to be winning battles for God to promote his kingdom. And so, really, David's situation parallels us in an interesting way. Well, chapter 28 begins. Now, it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, "You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men." And David said to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do." David's playing along. And Achish said to David, "Therefore, I will make you one of my chief guardians forever." Achish was convinced that David had swapped sides, that he had been a traitor. He'd now flipped over to the Philistine cause. Meanwhile, back in Saul's court, King Saul reaches some new heights of madness. Notice verse 3. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him and buried him in Ramah, in his own city. Now, Samuel has been God's prophet to Israel. For decades now, whenever God has wanted to deliver a message to his people, God has gone through his prophet Samuel. And Saul is just about to need some important guidance. But the problem here, the reason this verse is inserted, is that Samuel's no longer around. Who is Saul going to turn to? Who can he go to for direction? Verse 3. And Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. Now, this was a noble act from Saul's earlier years. You remember, Saul started out sincere. He wanted to serve God. Problem, he just wanted to serve himself more. That's the problem with a lot of people. And in a stand for righteousness, Saul had excommunicated the witches and the New Age channelers and the palm readers and the fortune tellers and the astrologers. Everyone who had dabbled in the occult. Guys, be careful of any method of obtaining supernatural power or guidance that sidesteps God. This is what the Bible calls the occult or spiritism. We're forbidden to practice such things. But once again, and this was a trait indicative of Saul, the king fails to obey God fully. This is where we get into trouble, when we don't fully obey the Lord. In Leviticus chapter 20, verse 27, God had commanded Israel, "A man or a woman who is a medium or who has familiar spirits shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones. Their blood shall be upon them." But is that what Saul did? He didn't stone them. He didn't kill them. He just ran them out of town. If Saul had obeyed, and if he had eliminated these occultists as God had commanded him, this sad chapter would have never happened. Here's what happened. Saul falls into the trap of his own partial obedience. And let me warn you, that's what partial obedience does. It becomes your own snare. Verse 4, "Then the Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa." And this is deep into the heartland of Israel. The Philistines are making an aggressive advance here. "When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets." You remember, Saul's downfall had occurred 30 years earlier when he failed to obey the Lord at Gilgal. Because he didn't do what God had told him to do, afterwards, we were told the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. Problem now is he's in desperate need of guidance. He tries to pray, but the heavens are like brass, and Samuel is no longer around to bail him out. Understand, God isn't trying to be mean to Saul, but why do we expect God to speak to us when we don't obey what he's already told us? You ever thought about that? You see, Saul had already proved that he was unwilling to obey God. He was unwilling to serve God. Why should God give him further instructions? Saul can pray all he wants, but God won't play. That's the issue here. Well, then Saul said to his servants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "In fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor." Now, Endor was in Philistine territory. And there is a tradition that suggests that this witch was actually the mother of Abner, who was Saul's general at the time. And this is why Saul's men didn't have to go far to search for a medium. Abner knew where his mom was at. She was down in Endor. The other reason that Saul met this witch in Endor was because he knew he was committing an abomination, and he didn't want anybody to see him. He was too ashamed to meet with her outside, so he met her indoors. And that's why they met in Endor. And so Saul disguised himself, and he put on other clothes, and he went and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. Saul knew he was committing an abomination. The king was ashamed of his actions, so he came to the witch incognito. Saul shows up disguised in costume. Call it the first Halloween costume. Remember, after Saul's rebellion against God at Gilgal, Samuel had warned Saul, "Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft." And I'm sure that at the time, Saul was appalled at Samuel's statement to accuse him of being guilty of a sin like witchcraft. Who would have ever thunk that Saul would eventually turn toward a witch for guidance? How can rebellion be on the par with witchcraft? And yet here, because of Saul's persistent rebellion, he eventually does turn to Satan and to witchcraft for guidance. Guys, be careful of undercover evils. Be careful of these subtle evils we hold in our hearts. Sins of the heart ultimately lead to abominable acts. There's also a little-known Jewish legend that says when Saul walked up to the witch at Endor, she had this silly grin on her face. She's just kind of smiling with this kind of smirk on her face and all. And when Saul walked up to her, he threatened her. He said, "Woman, wipe that smile off your face." And when she refused, Saul hauled off and slapped her. Well, later he was arrested and charged with striking a happy medium. My, oh my. Well, in reality, Saul asked the woman, and he said, "Please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you." Saul wants to talk to the dead, a particular practice that was forbidden by God. And then the woman said to him, "Look, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums." Remember, he's in disguise. "And the spirit is from the land. Why then do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die?" The witch has no idea who she's speaking to and how far the king had fallen from God, that he would be consulting her. And Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you from this thing." Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." And what happens next is a total surprise. The witch doesn't even have time to quote her incantations and to cast her mysterious spells. All of a sudden, she is shocked by what she sees. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." She realizes that this is a sting operation. At least that's what she thinks. She's about to get by. This is a setup. Notice when the witch sees Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. As soon as she saw a real person, she became frightened. She was scared spitless. Philip Keller, he writes this of this incident. "In terror, she screamed, for this was not the usual weird apparition that came to her otherwise beclouded mind and deluded spirit. This was an act of the living Lord." This was the one time in her life when what she asked for truly happened. That's why she was so scared. See, I believe she was shocked by the reality of the phenomena. Normally, a seance was a farce. She was pulling the wool over somebody's eyes to take their money. Or perhaps a demon appeared, and she recognized it as such. Evidently, on this occasion, this was an exception that had never occurred before. God allowed Saul a brief communication with Samuel. The only other time that I'm aware in the Bible that this happens is on the Mount of Transfiguration, when Elijah and Moses appear and talk to Jesus. Moses certainly had returned from the dead. Normally, though, this practice is forbidden. The spirit world obeys God's boundaries. And Luke chapter 16 reveals the travel rules for the dead. You want to know what the travel rules are for all dead people? Here it is. You remember when the rich man in hell wanted to return and warn his lost brothers of the horrors that awaited them if they didn't repent and come to God? God forbid him to return to this earth. If they haven't listened to Moses and the prophets, what makes you think they're going to listen to you? He was forbidden to pass over that gulf or to come back to this life. You see, once you've been assigned to heaven or hell, there are no passes. There are no furloughs. What happens here in 1 Samuel chapter 28 is the exception to the normal rules of eternity. Well, verse 13 tells us, "And the king said to her, 'Do not be afraid. What do you see?' And the woman said to Saul, 'I see a spirit ascending out of the earth.' And so he said to her, 'What is his form?' And she said, 'An old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle.' And Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and he stopped with his face to the ground and bowed down. And now Samuel said to Saul, 'Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?'" In other words, I was having a great time. "You're pulling me away from the party, man. What's the deal here?" He's a little perturbed for being disturbed. That's why if I have a heart attack and I fall dead and one of you guys comes up here and does CPR on me and revives me, first thing I'm going to do is punch you in the mouth. "Why'd you do that to me? I was with Jesus, man. I was partying with the Lord. Why did you bring me back to this world?" That was kind of Samuel's reaction. And Saul answered, "I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may reveal to me what I should do." And then Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy?" And I told you that a long time ago. "And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand, and he's given it to your neighbor David, because you did not obey the voice and execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore, the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." Now, not necessarily in paradise, but in the afterlife, that's what he's saying. In other words, tomorrow you're going to die. "The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." And then immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. I would imagine so. Saul had been sentenced by God. "And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night. And the woman came to Saul and saw that he was severely troubled and said to him, 'Look, your maidservant has obeyed your voice, and I have put my life in my hands and heeded the words which you spoke to me. Now, therefore, please heed also the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you and eat, that you may have strength when you go on your way.' But he refused and said, 'I won't eat.'"
We are so glad you joined us today as Pastor Sandy teaches through 1 Samuel. As we go through this book, we get to see all the ways that God's plans seldom follow human patterns. He chooses Hannah, who is barren, to be the mother of Samuel, and Samuel becomes the prophet of God instead of the sons of the priest. Later on, God chooses David, the youngest and least likely of the sons, to be king. In 1 Samuel 16, we discover the reason behind God's purposes when he says, "Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." It doesn't matter who you are or what position you hold. God is able to see your heart. He will use you for his purposes if you will open your heart to him. If you have prayer needs as you go through this journey, we'd like to be the ones praying with you. Give us a call at 770-736-2828. Once again, that's 770-736-2828. We'd also love to connect with you on Facebook or Twitter. Or for those of you who live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, Pastor Sandy would love to meet you and shake your hand at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We gather weekly to praise God, study His Word, and get to know one another. You can find directions and service times at our website, sandyadams.org. We're all out of time for today, but we hope you join us again next time as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through 1 Samuel.